How do you write the biography of a living legend, one who happens to be an uncompromising perfectionist to boot? That's what biographer Walter Isaacson did when Steve Jobs called on him to write the definitive story of his life. This hour, Isaacson is here to talk about the challenges of writing that book, reconciling stories Jobs told with the tales of those around him. We'll also talk about Jobs' unique talent for marrying art with technology. Plus, as the daylight hours dwindle, are you suffering from the winter blues? Coming up, a look at seasonal depression, sad, and some ways to beat it, like light therapy or a trip to the beach. All coming up after this break, so stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Have you noticed how short the days are getting? Is it having an effect on you? Maybe you have a little trouble rolling out of bed each morning, or you're feeling a little bit sluggish, a little depressed even. Well, the good news is it's a normal reaction to less daily sunlight. But why do you get the winter blues? And is there some evolutionary advantage to all of this? In some people, the depression can be more acute. Seasonal affective disorder, SAD. What can they do about it? That's what we'll be talking about. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Dr. Richard A. Friedman is a professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College here in New York. He is here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Dr. Friedman, what exactly is going on that causes this seasonal depression?
Well, what we think is going on is that people are essentially beginning to respond to the fact that the days are getting shorter. And so daylight gets shorter during the winter, and there are a group of people that respond by feeling lethargic and tired and sad, and they want to sleep more and eat more and have less sex.
Uh-huh. And how do you know if you're one of the people who has this full-blown seasonal affective disorder?
Well, because you have a repeated pattern of depression the same time every year. That is, when the photo period starts to get short and the winter is coming on. And then when the winter lets up and spring comes, you start to feel good again.
Do we actually know what's going on in your brain when this happens?
Well, we know what's going on in other animals who display behavior that's somewhat like humans, that is a kind of hibernating behavior. So we think it's linked to the hormone melatonin, which basically is the signal that tells your brain that it's nighttime.
So could you just take melatonin pills and solve it that way?
You can manipulate melatonin, but it's not as effective as light so far.
So you want to get more light, artificially if you have to, right?
Right. You want to basically fool the brain into thinking winter's not here and that, you know, the days are actually not getting shorter.
And how do you do that?
You administer light in the morning. And you essentially tell the brain, hey, it's time to wake up. It's actually daylight.
Yeah.
So basically what you want to do is override the signal from the season that is telling you the days are shorter, the photo period's getting smaller, and you can override it with light.
Now, do you need to get a prescription for a light box, or can you go out and buy one yourself? Or can you self-diagnose this, or is it better to... Maybe you could try it and see if it works.
Yes. Light is highly effective, very safe, very few side effects. Most people who have seasonal depression are aware of the pattern. You don't need a prescription to get a light box. And you can buy one yourself on multiple websites.
1-800-989-8255. Someone is tweeting us saying, what about a tanning bed? People get into tanning beds. Is that the same thing, or will that help? Or are you going to get brown at the same time?
Well, that's a bit dangerous because the exposure to UV light is carcinogenic and it's harmful. And basically, you want visible light spectrum in your getting in your eyes. You don't want to be exposed to UV light.
And for how many hours a day?
You don't need much exposure. You know, basically 20 to 30 minutes in the morning when the brain is the most sensitive to light does the trick.
And if it's working, you'll know it immediately.
It's very fast. The treatment has an onset of action that's much faster than antidepressants.
And much cheaper.
Much cheaper. And less side effects.
And a lot less side effects. Why is there some evolutionary advantage to this? Why would people have this happening?
It's a fascinating question. Well, it seems like there might be, in the sense that, you know, people who have seasonal depression look like they're going through some sort of energy conservation strategy. They're eating less. They're conserving energy. They're more tired. They want to be a couch potato. They consume a lot of calories. They look like, in a sense, they're hibernating. Not hibernating in the in the way that bears hibernate, where their body temperature goes down. And in fact, there are very interesting scientific experiments that have been done looking at people who have seasonal depression and looking at the difference in their melatonin secretion during the winter compared to people that don't. And they behave like hibernating animals, because what happens is that as the daylight gets shorter, their nighttime gets longer, and their melatonin secretion gets longer in the winter, so like hibernating animals.
Well, how do we know that we're not the abnormal people and they're the normal people?
Well, in a sense, we might be the abnormal people in the sense that, you know, people that don't have seasonal depression have a constant melatonin secretion all year long, even though daylight is getting shorter, and probably because we're sensitive to artificial light. So with artificial light, we've extended the day.
Are there people who actually go the opposite direction?
There, you mean people who are depressed in the summer?
Yeah.
Yes. They're a smaller group of people, and mostly you find those people in the South, and for some reason in Asian countries. So there's a smaller, much smaller percent of seasonal depressives that have summer, you know, depressions.
And now I've heard of therapies that involve going to the beach instead. Why would going to the beach work?
Well, for two reasons. One, it's very sunny.
Yeah.
Two, it's very beautiful. And three, it's filled with negative ions.
The beaches.
The beaches, yes. Wet, damp places have an excess of negative charge. And although it sounds like snake oil, actually, there's good empirical evidence that negative ion generators can actually improve seasonal depression, just like phototherapy.
So you could get a negative ion generator.
You could get a negative, high flow negative ion generator. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard about I've heard of a positive negative ions for years.
Well,
I've heard about,
you know, the folklore about these hot, dry winds that drive people mad. Well, there's actually some scientific basis behind it, because these hot, dry winds like the Santa Ana and the Fern and the Mistral are full of positive ions, and they do drive people.
Because I've also heard that the way animals know that the weather is going to change, or people, they start sniffing the air, that they're detecting possibly the ion change and that's coming.
Yeah, possibly.
Also, there's this. Is it easier to get the light box or the negative ion generator, would you suggest?
Probably easier at this point to get the light box, and maybe cheaper.
Is it? Yeah.
I think so.
And you can build your own if you want.
You could, although the issue is you want to really be sure that you've got a filter that will take away as much UV light as possible, because you don't want to harm your eyes.
Right. You know, people will say to you, why don't you just get out of bed and go jog someplace? You'll feel a lot better.
Yes. Well, people who don't experience depression always say things like that. You pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. It's very hard.
Yeah, if you could get out of bed, you wouldn't be depressed.
By definition.
By definition. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We're talking to Richard Friedman, professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College here in New York. When Steve Jobs first began his battle with cancer, he called up my next guest, the biographer Walter Isaacson, and asked him if he might consider writing the definitive story of his life. Isaacson had written biographies of Einstein, Ben Franklin, Kissinger. You know, you've read all those books. And Jobs told him, quote, I think you're good at getting people to talk. Isaacson turned Jobs down a number of times, but finally accepted when he found out Jobs might not have long to live. The finished book, entitled simply Steve Jobs, is the fruit of more than 40 meetings between the two and over 100 interviews with Jobs' family, colleagues, friends, and enemies. For the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about some of the challenges of writing that book, such as weaving together Jobs' version of events in his life with those of the people around him. Sometimes those stories didn't actually quite match up. And we're going to look at Jobs' legacy on our personal gadgets and how he became such a wizard at marrying great art and design with great, or maybe I should say insanely great, technology. Walter Isaacson is the author of the new book, Steve Jobs, and he's CEO of the Aspen Institute, and he joins us here in New York. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Good to be back, Ira. Nice to see you.
Is there any question somebody has not asked you yet?
I don't know. I don't want to leave the impression that I turned down Steve many, many, many times.
Tell us the story.
Well, I just kept saying, you know, hey, you're young. You're in the middle of a career. Let's do this 20 or 30 years from now. And I didn't quite realize how sick he was. But once I realized that, you know, he was battling cancer and, you know, he had now transform the telephone and iPad industry, I was pretty eager to do the book.
Mm-hmm. It reminded some of the people we talked to about being the chosen biographer of royalty when they want to have their best portraits painted of them. Did you think of that at all?
Well, the odd thing was he's a very much of a controlling guy. He loves to control everything from end to end, which is why you can't open up your iPhone and why, you know, the Mac software and the Mac hardware are tightly integrated. But he kept saying, I don't want to have any control of this book. This will be yours. And be independent. Be honest. Interview other people. I'm choosing you because you can get other people to talk. And for a while, I was wary, but he opened up, never asked to see anything. And, you know, he also had a style that was honest. He was sometimes brutally honest. And he kept saying, I should try to be honest in the book.
Except he wanted the cover for himself.
Oh, he hated when he saw the cover that we put in the catalog. He just hated it. And he, you know what? He was right. It was one of those gimmicky kind of had him and an apple or something. It was in one of those catalogs about 8-9 months ago. And he called me up. I hadn't really felt the brunt of his fury. But I remember landing at San Francisco because I was going to go see him. And he told me to just turn around, that the cover was so ugly. He used words other than ugly, but they had the same number of letters. That, you know, it showed that we had no taste. So after hearing him rant for maybe 10 minutes or so, he said, the only way I'll cooperate is if you let me have some input into the cover. So I paused and I thought for maybe one and a half seconds and said, you know, this is the best designer of products in our time.
And he knew
I'd love that.
And he knew it's all about the cover,
and, you know,
didn't he?
He said nobody's going to read the book anyway, so you might as well just have a good cover.
And because of the covers of all the objects he was involved with, the Mac and the iPad, the iPhone, those were the important part of the design was important to him.
I must admit I was stunned by the depth of his obsession with design the more I heard about it. Even in the late 1970s when he's going to Sony to finger all the brochures and then starts hating the heavy industrial design of Sony, goes to the Aspen Design Conference and gets hooked on the Bauhaus, the simplicity of the Bauhaus movement. And I think it was, you know, his dad, when he was like 6 years old, they were making a fence around the backyard of the house. And his father said, we have to make the back of the fence as pretty as the front. And Steve said, why? Nobody will ever know. And his father said, you'll know.
You'll know. Yeah. You'll know.
And that's why in the Macintosh, which you couldn't open up, he made the first Mac, or for that matter, the current Mac, with the screws that you can't actually open. And he said, we got to make the inside as beautiful as the outside. We'll know.
Right. We will know. We'll talk more with Walter Isaacson, author of the new book, Steve Jobs. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, and go to our website at sciencefriday.com and our Facebook page, SciFry. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Well, the holidays are right around the corner, and if you're already trying to get your holiday gift list together, may I request that you keep Science Friday in your thoughts. It may be hard to believe, but the bulk of our funding comes from private donations like yours. This is what goes to create the radio show, our podcasts, websites, social media, phone apps. So please give what you can, $5, $10, whatever works for you. We'll send you a tax-deductible receipt, and you can even make donations as a gift to someone else. Just visit our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the link to support us. And thanks.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Walter Isaacson, author of the new book, Steve Jobs, and he's also the CEO of the Aspen Institute. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Walter, you have written about the biggest names in science and technology. Einstein, Ben Franklin, we'll throw Kissinger in there with it.
Political science.
Political science. You must have thought about the comparisons between Steve and these other people.
Well, you know, I like writing about the life of the mind. I don't know. I think I was on your show once. I was talking about maybe writing about Louis Armstrong.
Yes.
And I could never get my head into Louis Armstrong's head. I knew everything about him except for whether he was happy, you know, major things like how he thought. So I love interesting minds. And since you're the host of this show, you've probably met more smart people than anybody I know. And you probably learned that smart people don't often amount to much. You know, it's really the creative people, the people who have an imaginative leap, an intuitive leap, who think different, as Steve said in the ads for the Apple computers. That's what I found in Einstein in particular. As you know, he wasn't the best physicist in 1905. Right. He couldn't even get a job at a university. He was working at a patent office. But he kind of thought differently. He said, well, how do we know time is absolute? Likewise, Steve was not the best engineer in Silicon Valley by a long shot, not nearly as good as his friend Steve Wozniak. But he was able to think different and imagine the future. And to me, we talk about the – I mean, the reason I write about scientists is I'm not a scientist, but I like combining science and the humanities. Sometimes we divide people into people who are the science geeks and the people who are the humanities geeks. In some ways, it's the combination of the humanities and the science that leads to great creativity. You see that in Ben Franklin. You see it in Albert Einstein, and you see it, of course, and Steve Jobs. Mm.
Where did he get his passion for arts and design that he put in? I remember from the early days of the Mac, and one thing that set the early Mac apart is it had all this calligraphy in it.
He drops out of it.
You know, he had all these fonts you never heard of, and he kept putting them in there himself.
I know. He kept designing the fonts. He drops out of Reed College, but the one thing he does is he just hangs around, stays on campus, and takes a calligraphy course. He loves the beautiful lettering, the fonts. Mm-hmm. And so when he develops a Macintosh, it has a bitmap screen, which means instead of just characters, you can actually take each pixel, and each pixel is connected, is mapped to a part of the microprocessor. So you can make a sans-serif font or a script or whatever you want. So he gets Susan Kare, this wonderful young designer, and Andy Hertzfeld, and they're designing fonts so that the type on your screen doesn't look like that horrible ASCII text you and I are old enough to remember on computers in the old days. And he would spend the nights looking at the fonts, and the people on the board and the top management at Apple were like, fonts, why are we dealing with this? And at one point, Susan Kare, who designed some of the fonts, named them after her hometown of Philadelphia, the stops on the mainline train. Like Rosemont. And he said, these are first-class fonts. We have to name them after first-class cities. And that's why the fonts you see now are named New York, Geneva, you know, all the names of great cities.
Mm-hmm. And he was obsessed with the tiniest details of his products, almost to the point of distraction you talk about in the book. Just choosing the right shade of beige for the computer case.
Yeah,
the perfect.
Pantone is one of these color companies that has probably thousands of shades of beige. None suited him. This drove the other people at Apple nuts. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the late 1970s before they're a big old company. Likewise, it continues throughout his career. There's a wonderful scene when they come out with the iMac, that sort of translucent Biondi blue. I think it's 98, 1999. And there he is yelling at poor Lee Clow that the pictures of it, it's not effing blue enough. And just even when they do the original Mac, Bill Atkinson makes perfect squares that they can render instantly. He also makes perfect circles they can render instantly. So he says, but we need rounded rectangles. And Atkins says, no, that's almost impossible to do. He said, no. And he makes him go on a walk and look at the windows and look at no parking signs and look at mirrors, look at the screens of a computer and say everything is a rectangle with rounded corners. And Bill Atkinson has to figure out a sequence of numbers, you know, so he can produce square roots, which the microprocessor they had couldn't do, so that he could produce rounded rects, which is why when you're looking at that computer screen, there are wonderful little folders and icons, all of which have rounded corners on their rectangles.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a call or two in here. Let's go to Jenna in St. Mary's, Kansas. Hi, Jenna. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks. I'm glad you took my call.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, after all those interviews with him, I mean, you point out his eye for detail and his drive for perfection. Do you think that's what made him successful?
I think the ability to connect artistry to science is what made him successful. He was somebody who felt a deep emotional attachment to beauty. He'd sometimes cry when he talked about a beautiful object, or when he talked about a letter he was going to write his wife on his anniversary, or when he would, you know, talk about an advertising copy for the Think Different ads. He felt poetic beauty was something that made you cry, and he drove engineers to be able to do it. To me, that's a real source of his genius.
Thank you, Jenna.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks,
Jen.
You know, it reminds me of the Richard Feynman statement about looking at a flower.
Yeah.
And he says, as an artist looks at a flower, you see the colors and the shape, but I know what's working inside the flower, and I see more beauty than you do because I know the details.
One day when they have flat screens and they're trying to make the new iMac using a flat screen, Johnny Ive, the world's greatest industrial designer, is working with Steve at Apple, and he comes up with something in which there's the computer attached to the back of the flat screen. And Steve says he hates it, probably in the same words he used to tell me he hated the original cover of the book. And he says it doesn't have integrity. It's not true to the flat screen nature, which is supposed to float and feel free. So he just goes home, Jobs does, and sits in his backyard. And then Johnny comes over to see him. And there's a profusion of sunflowers in the backyard. And as they look at the sunflower, they figure out, oh, that's what computers will look like. They'll have that wonderful curved neck, and that will be something that will hold the screen so it floats and feels as if it were at your disposal. And the curved neck of that new iMac, which you've seen, the sunflower iMac, yeah. Steve Jobs has a design patent on it in his own name from sitting in the backyard thinking that up.
Is that the domed one with the white dome on the bottom? And the
yeah, the one, yeah.
I have that in my office. So.
Oh, you're dating yourself.
Oh, I go further back than that.
I know.
989-8255. One of the things I've wondered about, and I've heard him quoted as saying this, is why are his products made overseas? I would think that the only way he could have had his legacy better than the icon that he is now is to have created all these jobs for his products, jobs in this country. He used to talk about, I can't get a factory built here. It takes 40,000 steps to get a factory built here. I can do it all overseas.
And
did he ever talk about any of that?
Totally. Yeah. He talked about it all the time. Yeah. And he talked about it to President Obama. He had a couple of meetings with Obama, a dinner with Obama. Obama came to the Westin Hotel in San Francisco to see him. And that's what Steve talked about, which is two things. If you want to build a factory in China, you can do it in 6 months. And in the first 3 months, you can start moving people in as the top floors are being built. Now, that's probably not the way we want to do it in the United States. On the other hand, you go to the other extreme. You want to build a factory in California. You know, you have 6 months just filling out the forms for the regulations and the environmental reviews or whatever it may be. I believe in all of those things, but I believe there's some happy medium so you can build a factory. Secondly, he said, our country does not turn out enough trained engineers anymore to support factory workers. There are about 700,000 factory workers at Foxconn, which is the Chinese companies and Taiwanese-owned companies that build a lot of Apple products. To support 700,000 engineers, 700,000 factory workers, you need about 30,000 engineers. That's the ratio. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about engineers, you know, who went to Caltech, MIT, or Harvard necessarily. We're talking about people like my dad who went to LSU or Tulane or a community college and got great industrial engineering degrees and could help work and build things in this country. We no longer create the number of engineers, and if we train an engineer from another country, as soon as they get their engineering degree, instead of stapling a green card to their visa, we kick them out of the country. And he said, I'm not going to be able to build factories unless there are enough engineers. And our school systems stink. He actually used a stronger word, but yeah. Mm.
So he was aware that that was a shortcoming, and that's something we should be working on, speaking to the president about it.
Oh, yeah. He was very aware, very worried about the state of education in America. I think he would have been – look, when he built the original Mac, he built a beautiful state-of-the-art factory in Fremont, California. He made the walls totally painted white. He wanted to be a showcase. Same thing happens when he does next computer. But nowadays, he says, it's hard to build a factory and it's hard to get the engineers to staff a factory. I'm sure there are people who can do it, but it'd be nice if we had a country that made this easier. Mm-hmm. Manufacturing is very important to this country. You're not going to have great industrial design, great engineers, or great, you know, product people once you allow all the manufacturing to go overseas.
So it was not just a question of profit margin, making it cheaper.
I don't think Steve was ever driven by pure profits. He was driven by making insanely great products, and those aren't the same thing. Everything you do, he says, if your goal is to make a great product, is different than if your goal is to make a profit. The people you promote, the people you hire, the way you do things, the way you build the inside of the machine. I think that obviously with any company, they'd be insane not to try to figure out how to make a profit. On the other hand, I think you would have been happy to have factories in the United States if you could build great products.
Talking with Walter Isaacson, author of Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson, a terrific book and very easy to read. And as a geek myself, I was struck by the back cover, which a lot of people don't look at a lot. And it has the young Steve Jobs with the original iMac in it.
And you notice how he's sitting? The yes, lotus position. He had just finished his Buddhist training.
And you know the geek in me is saying, look, there's a floppy disk in the machine.
And it looks like a human face with a smile, which is the way he wanted it designed.
Is that right?
He said, I want it friendly. And you see that strip on the top of the original Mac?
Yeah.
He kept saying, make it narrower. It looks like a Neanderthal. I want it to look like a friendly person. I want it to look like a smile.
And when it booted up, if I remember, it had that smiling face.
It said hello with a smiling face. And that was it. The designers of the original Mac kept saying, we did not know what it meant when he kept saying, make it friendlier. But even when you get to the current desktop computers of Apple, the iMacs and stuff, for a while he put a recessed handle in it. Not because you're going to carry your desktop around, but he said the handle made it clear that the computer defers to you and you can touch it and made it friendly.
Yeah, I remember that. They came in colors.
You know, the fact that he's sitting in the lotus position amused me too, because one of his strengths too was combining that counterculture of the late 60s and early 70s, that quest for enlightenment with the scientific Silicon Valley culture. You found that in California then, people who went off to India to seek spiritual enlightenment but were also president of the Electronics Club. And Steve is the embodiment of that whole Earth catalog, Tools for Living, that took computers, which used to be sort of tools of the power structure and unfriendly, and said, no, they empower you. They're your friend. They're personal.
Talking with Walter Isaacson on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking about his new book, Steve Jobs. That's all that had to be said in the title, didn't it? Steve Jobs.
I know. The original title we thought of was
I, Steve.
My daughter. You know, she's at college. She said that was the stupidest, geekiest thing. My wife hated it and Steve hated it. And I said, wait a minute. What would Steve Jobs do? You know,
is it
a simple title.
Is it enough for us to just say Steve and everybody knows who we're talking about?
I don't. I guess so. I'm not sure, you know, a generation from now. But Steve Jobs, it's like Apple Computer. It's a simple, direct name.
Did he ever think about, and I have thought about this over the years, if you we wanted to retool, you're talking about his business acumen, and that was one of his strengths. We wanted to retool manufacturing, and especially the car industry here that almost went bankrupt. Why couldn't Steve been assigned to build an iCar? And come
you know,
up with an idea
he
like
talked to me about that. He said, you know, if I really had another career and another life, I'd love to build a car. And you know why? His father was an auto mechanic, the guy who adopted him, Paul Jobs. He repossessed cars from people who couldn't pay their loan, I mean, for a finance company. But then he fixed them up and sold them back. And what Steve learned from watching his father is how a car company integrates everything. You don't have to go buy the software somewhere and the engine somewhere and the headlight somewhere and the chassis somewhere. It's all built together in an integrated fashion. And that's what Steve Jobs liked to do with his computers, unlike, say, Dell or Microsoft, where somebody makes a hardware, somebody makes a software. And at the end, I asked him, this end-to-end integration of product, who else does it well? I mean, I was seeing if there's any other technology company. He said, no technology companies. The companies that do it well are the car companies. And then he paused and he said, or at least they used to. So he always told me if he had had another career, he would have loved to have built the greatest car. I think that's true of television as well. I mean, you talk about brain dead products.
Right.
the fact that your VCR has a remote control that is totally complicated and unconnected to the remote control with your TV that's hooked up to a cable box, all totally uninterrupted. You should be able to do what you do with your iPad. Pull it out of a box, boot it up, and it'll do what you want.
Did he figure that out before?
He said he cracked it. He said he cracked the interface, how to make it simple. And I also think it was part of a philosophy of iCloud, that every device you have, your iPod, your iPhone, it should have synchronize automatically your pictures, your music, your video, the things you want to watch. Life should be simple. And it was Michelangelo who said it. Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, and that became Steve's mantra.
And there was another – I can't remember the technologist it was either or the author is either Isaac Asimov or one of the other people who said that the best technology not only is it magical, but you don't have to know that it's there when it's working.
That's the iPad. Everything he did had a certain magical quality. You're right.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. I only have about a minute to the break, and Walter will be staying with us. Did he know? Can he look at something and say, you know, this is something you'll want to have before I make it, you're going to want it now?
You know, at the first retreat that the Macintosh team takes in the early 1980s, somebody says, we ought to have some focus groups to see what people want. And Steve says, how do people know what they want until we've shown them? And he quoted Henry Ford saying, if I had done focus groups, people would have told me they wanted a faster horse. So he said at the end of the book, I just have him talking about his legacy. Mm-hmm. He says, it's our job to read what's on the page before other people see it written on the page. And I think he had that emotional connection that allowed him to do that.
1-800-989-8255. Talking with Walter Isaacson. The book is Steve Jobs. You can tweet us at SciFry. And as I say, the number again, 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/SciFry. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Walter Isaacson, author of the new book, Steve Jobs. He is also the CEO of the Aspen Institute. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Walter, you write in the book that you sometimes heard many different versions of how a particular meeting or relationship played out. You had one from Steve, you had four from others. How did you reconcile those different things?
Well, I think that's what journalists or writers try to do is gather information, say, here in my gut is where I think it's true. And I don't think it's because people were misleading. It's just that he had a very strong personality and force field around him. So the day he resigned in August, a month or two ago, as CEO of Apple, I talked to him right after the resignation. He told me the whole story and what he said and what he did. And then within a day, I had talked to three people on the board, and they told me the whole story. And there were, some different versions of it. I think that a journalist can usually try to get at the truth, but you make mistakes, and then later on you'll write and correct them. Also, you sometimes err on a side of kindness because you could always take the most sensational story, Steve and then he bit my head off story.
Right.
But you actually want to put it into a context of, and then we actually got the job done and Steve was right and he made us do amazing things. So you try to put it in the context of here's the best explanation that helps you appreciate the guy.
Mm-hmm. Your book isn't very flattering in how it portrays Steve's relationship with other people. Sometimes.
Especially in the beginning.
He
was a tough customer, very demanding. There's a passion for perfection, and he divides everybody into heroes and dunces. I mean, either you're the best ever artist or you totally stink at what you do. And so he could be brutal. But as I said just a moment ago, I try to put it in the context of when he gets the team right, he's able to tell them, you can shave 10 seconds off the boot up time at the Mac. And they say, no, that's impossible. And he convinces them, if you can do it. And in the end, they shave 28 seconds off of it. So he's able to convince them they can do the impossible, sometimes by being very brusque and rude. He says, look, brutal honesty is the price of admission for being in the room with me. I can tell you you're full of it. You can tell me I'm full of it. But in the end, they used to give an award at the old Macintosh team of those, the person who stood up to Steve the best during the year. It was usually won by a woman, you know, Joanna Hoffman, Debbie Coleman. They got promoted. They stuck with Steve. By the end, he's got, I mean, people would not have stayed with him if he were a true jerk. By the end of his career, both at Apple, everywhere else, he's got a very loyal set of top-notch players who actually are more faithful and loyal and inspired by him than any other company has.
And in one of those instances you talk about in the book, he occasionally appreciates it when sometimes being proven wrong. And I'm going to talk about the disk drive for the Macintosh story.
Oh, that's where he finally taught the people around him, sometimes you have to just defy me. For a while, they're doing the Mac, the original Macintosh.
Right.
You're right, the first Macintosh. And he wants some disk drive that some company he thinks is better at making it. They know, the engineers, that that company is going to screw it up. So they secretly get Sony, a guy from Sony, to help develop the disk drive. And whenever Steve comes around, they have to hide him. And at one point, Steve came unexpectedly onto the engineering floor, and they pushed the poor Sony engineer into a closet. And he finally says, I do not mind, but your American business habits are very strange. Steve, when he found out that they had done that, and frankly, it saved his bacon because they did need the new drive, he just smiled and said, I guess I taught you guys right.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Bob in Plymouth, Michigan. Hi, Bob.
Oh, hi. Glad you had time. I wanted to ask Mr. Eichmann about the meeting between Steve Jobs and Ken Olson from Digital Equipment. I don't know if that ever happened, but the rumor was around Digital and Maynard for a long time that Steve wanted to talk to Ken about possibly, you know, working together. Ken, of course, didn't like PCs, but Digital was pretty good with networks, and I guess it's a little scary to think what Jobs and Ken together might have come up with regarding networking and internet and so forth. Did he ever, does Mr. Eisen know whether that actually happened? Or?
No, I don't know much about that meeting. Steve met, of course, with all sorts of business leaders, and he said, in praising Bill Gates once, he said, we like to have end-to-end control at Apple of the mm-hmm. hardware, the software, the content, and everything else. Because Microsoft will license out and work with others. They have embedded in their genetic code the ability to collaborate with other companies. And it's not one of the strengths of Apple, and it's not one of my strengths. And that's a nice way of saying that Steve often clashed with partners, rivals, whatever. He had a very good relationship with Intel because they made the chips. But even then, with the great Paul Ottolini running Intel, you know, there are times when they can't agree on making the right chip for the product that Apple wants. So Steve was not at his best when it came to making business alliances.
And his final relationship with Bill Gates, how did that wind up?
Absolutely astonishing. I mean, if you want a history of the digital age, you need to look at these two people. I call it a binary star system, which your listeners would appreciate because it's, you know, two stars whose gravitational pull on each other causes their orbits to be linked. Starting in the late 70s, Bill Gates, with a fledgling company called Microsoft, is writing Word programs and, you know, spreadsheet programs for the Apple II and the original Mac. And
people forget that. I remember that, you know.
Bill Gates told me, he said, I used to go to every one of those Hawaii marketing meetings for Apple and be there on, you know, fake game shows and dating games that we did together and there for all the dances. They were very close. There was a rivalry and a respect, a friendship and a competition. And, of course, it got really bad when Bill Gates creates Windows, which Steve felt was a ripping off of the look and feel of the Macintosh operating system. You know, Bill Gates said, well, you know, we both ripped it off from Xerox. But no, I mean, it was actually, I can understand why Steve was mad because they had done great improvement. But by the very end, a few months ago, Bill comes by to visit and, you know, spends 3 hours talking with at Steve's home in Palo Alto about the 30-some-odd years they had spent together. And he even makes the admission that Steve, your way of integrating end-to-end products, that actually makes for beautiful products. And afterwards, Bill said, I said that to him, But I think only Steve Jobs could have done it. You had to have been an artist with a passion for detail and perfection to do that integration. When I told Steve that, he said, oh, no, that's bull. If Bill had wanted to, he could do it. But I said, well, who else did it? And that was the conversation we had about car companies were the only ones right. he thought of who did end-to-end integration.
Was Steve angry about his impending death?
No. I think, in fact, he kept believing he was going to outrun the cancer. He had his DNA sequenced. In fact, it was a whole genetic sequencing. And he was able to get molecular targeted therapy. You know, I talked at one point in the book about how he was trying to treat it with diets, but you have to realize he was also getting the most advanced scientific treatment that kept him alive for 7 years. And even in my last meeting with him, just, you know, a month or two before he died, he was saying, oh, I'm going to go on this new drug regimen. I think it's going to carry me through for another year. I think I'm going to outrun it. He used to call it the lily pad. I think I'll get to the next lily pad.
1-800-999-8255, talking with Walter Isaacson, author of the new book, Steve Jobs. Let's see if we can get a call to him. And here, Alfredo in Cleveland. Hi.
Hello, Ira. Hello, Walter.
Hello, sir. Alfredo.
Just wanted to hit three quick points. A friend's son just recently left Apple. As he described it, now this is a PhD in engineering from San Francisco over to China on a regular basis, and he left for what he described as a hostile work environment, which he felt was coming from the top down. And all the descriptions of all the kindness and elevating Mr. Jobs to virtual sainthood is kind of looking at one side, and I think, Walter, you mentioned erring on the side of kindness. I thought a journalist or author is supposed to err on the side of facts.
Well, you know, when you get 6 or 7 versions of a story, you always try to say exactly what was the truth. And I always aim for the honesty. I think if you look at the book, he would feel, you would feel, that I try to be very honest, including about the fact that he was not the most nurturing, sweetest of all bosses. And I hear where you're coming from. I do think there are lots of tales in the book in which I try to be very honest, but I do try to show that he does, by doing it, inspire most people, obviously not everybody, but most people, into being part of a loyal team that tends not to leave him.
And as far as workers in China being mistreated or that kind of criticism that was leveled against his company.
Yeah, you know, I can't sort of elevate him to sainthood there. He did not sit there as much and worry about the outsourcing to Foxconn. But they did, Apple as a company, spend a lot of time trying to make sure conditions at Foxconn and in China were improved. And I think Steve spent a lot of time thinking about how could we get more jobs back to America.
Mm. And so you think his legacy is intact?
I think his legacy will always be a mixed one of somebody who had a very artistic temperament, which could make him difficult to deal mm-hmm. with, but as a result created awesomely, insanely great, beautiful, emotionally connective products. But even more importantly, I think his legacy will be the creation of Apple. When I asked him, what's your best creation? I thought he'd say the iPad. He said Apple Computer. Because it is a place which we don't realize. You can't just do startups and products. You have to leave a place that nurtures the idea that imagination should be connected to technology. And there are not as many places in this country as there should be that nurture that. People say, I want to do a startup. I want to sell it. Google does it well. Apple does it well. And I think imagination, creativity, and technology should be welded. That will be his legacy.
But it took a vision of his vision to be able to hold it all together instead of piecemealing.
Right. And the question is, will Tim Cook and Johnny Ive and the 4 or 5 other top players in Apple be able to have a collaborative joint vision that holds it together? Johnny Ive is the best industrial designer of our era. Tim Cook is one of the best, probably the best manager, a corporate manager of our era. I think those people can hold it together 5 or 10 years from now. We'll see.
All right, Walter. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
Ira, it's always good to be with you.
Walter Isaacson, author of the new book, Steve Jobs. It's a great read. It's a giant book, but it goes really very, very fast right through it. And it's always a pleasure to have you. Thanks for coming.
I'll be back, I hope.
I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from NPR. With us now is Flora Lichtman. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
Your video pick of the week. And of course, it's going to be something special.
This is a special one. We go back in time for this one. It's this story. Let me set the scene for you. The story starts in the 50s with a dentist, William Rhine, who is also basically a bird fanatic. In fact, to the point that he makes these self-funded expeditions all over the world, including to Mexico several times, to look for one rare giant woodpecker, the imperial woodpecker. It's 2 feet tall.
Is this like the one they've been searching for?
It is a very close relative to the one they've been searching for here in this country,
right.
The ivory-billed woodpecker. It's its sort of closest relation. So he, on one of these trips, he manages to get this bird on film. And no one has captured this to anyone's knowledge in a photo or on film. But he wasn't happy with the footage, it sounds like, so he kept it under wraps. So for the longest time, the bird... The ornithology community thought there was no footage. Eventually, a very persistent ornithologist at Cornell tracks down a mention of the film, then goes and drives to Rhine's house. You know, this is 40 or 50 years after this expedition. Gets him to pop on the projector and gets this footage. He brings it back to Cornell and shows it to Tim Gallagher, who's sort of the star of our story in this video. And Tim Gallagher, when he sees this footage, this is how he describes it.
I mean, it was incredible. I mean, this bird's hitching up the tree and chipping off chunks of bark. It even takes off and flies 3 different times. It was just like seeing a ghost.
Wow. And you have the video, that footage of that video up on our video pick of the week.
You can see it for yourself.
And it is this incredible woodpecker that just, do we know, is it vanished? Is it extinct?
It's heavily endangered, if not extinct. So this video actually prompted Gallagher to go back to this very spot where Rhine camped and see if he could find this woodpecker. And in that journey had a lot of sort of scary adventures. It's become drug growing. Country.
It's in Mexico.
In the mountains of Mexico. And so he had quite an adventure looking. And he didn't find one. And he actually said that he was glad he didn't see one because it would just be too sad because there's almost no way you could protect a bird in that country.
Right. And that would be... impossible, right? Because of the violence.
So
going
lawless.
On.
I mean, the people can't even be protected, let alone the birds.
And so you have him on the video pick of the week.
We have the video
of the birds in a tree moving up and down, flying out of the tree.
Chip and bark. You should definitely go see it. But there's one other thing we want to do today. So we had, if you may remember, a few weeks ago, we did this contest with astronaut Don Pettit about the egg in space. Why does the watery egg wobble in space? And we have a winner.
We have a winner. Frank, with my bell.
Frank Tartaglia from Belleville, New Jersey. He was one of our winning answers. He was picked randomly, and he won a sci-fi pocket protector for his winning answer. And I just want to have him, I just want to play his answer for you.
My answer was that the moment of inertia was moving in the water-filled egg. And as astronaut Pettit pointed out in the podcast, when he was spinning the book, the moment of inertia was moving when he spun it that certain way. And I said, well, that's the answer. That's why it's wobbling, because the book was wobbling.
Are you a scientist?
No. I'm a computer programmer. So that pocket protector goes right along with my nerd image. In fact, it's been many years since I've had one because they're not easy to find, but I will wear mine proudly.
Very heartwarming.
Yes.
Well, I'm wearing mine proudly right now,
yes,
too.
Yes, we all are. We sold out of them. We're going to make a whole bunch of them, batch of them for
us. Yeah, and we'll have more contests.
More contests.
There will be other opportunities.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
A video pick of the week. You can see this rare woodpecker up there on our website from old footage taken over 50 years ago on the woodpecker. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.